From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. African-American activist Randall Robinson said Friday that U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell is, quote, an immoral traitor to his race. For supporting U.S. policy in Haiti, Robinson, the outspoken founder and former president of Trans Africa, 10 years ago made headlines himself when he fasted for 27 days to protest U.S. policy toward Haitian refugees. In 2001, 3 weeks before 9/11, he decided he had had enough of an America where blacks make up 50% of prison inmates and where the unemployment rate of blacks is twice that of whites. He moved with his family to the tiny Caribbean island of St. Kitts. The 62-year-old Robinson still pays close attention to what happens in the U.S. and in the world, to the war on terrorism, to Iraq and the Middle East, to the U.S. military's actions in Haiti. America, says Randall Robinson, has never been more dangerous to the world than now. Tonight on Point, Randall Robinson quits America. Listen and ask yourself, can you feel the depth of disillusion that would cause an American, a black American, to leave the United States? Do you see the disintegration of American democracy, culture, and morals that Randall Robinson bemoans? Is there a level of alienation that could lead you to quit America? What do you think of a man who has? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from St. Kitts is Randall Robinson, founder and former president of Trans Africa, a Washington advocacy group that monitors U.S. foreign policy. His new book is Quitting America: The Departure of a Black Man from His Native Land. He is also author of The Debt, The Reckoning, and Defending the Spirit. He joins us from his home on St. Kitts. Good evening and welcome, Randall Robinson.
Good evening.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
How has your day been on St. Kitts today, sir?
My day has been wonderful here.
This is a big statement from you, from Randall Robinson, about the United States and the world. I wish you'd just give us a little bit of the immediate history first. When and why did you decide to leave the United States?
I've been coming here for some 20 years. My wife is a native of St. Kitts, and so I was as much coming to St. Kitts as I was leaving the United States. I wanted to live at least a portion of my life in a society, in a culture, where every value was not measured, every success was not measured by the yardstick of money, where there were competing values, where there were things more important than money, where there were intimacies, and where there was a caring and a compassion in a smaller society, on a smaller level, smaller decencies, that yield a quality of happiness that one can't, in my view, enjoy in the United States, where the mall has essentially become the church. This is it is an eminently safer society, a more civil society, where one can walk the streets virtually any time of night without fear of being harmed, where crimes are conventional, where one doesn't find the pathology-written kinds of murders and that sort of thing that you see almost routinely in America, where children aren't kidnapped, where prisoners work on public works details cheek by jowl with the populace, and convicts are not considered former people, but actually members of the community. It's simply a saner, more civil, more human kind of society. So I was coming here as much as I was leaving there. And then, of course, there is a question of race. It's the kind of thing that you drag around behind you all of your life in America. It takes its toll. The toll is heavy, and to live even in a space free of it for a few minutes is a wonderful relief. And lastly, there is this this enormous disinclination on the part of Americans to examine themselves. I mean, it's the famous arrogance about which the world speaks, a kind of smothering narcissism about its own wonderfulness, as if it were the greatest country that were ever developed any time in history. Of course, that is nonsense. There's no such thing as the greatest country anywhere. St. Kitts has a suicide rate of zero. America has a substantially higher suicide rate. So one would think that to be a great country, or at least a great society, there would have to be a level of public contentment, kind of satisfaction of the spirit and in the heart. One would think those things were lacking in America. And in part, I think, it is because of this disinclination as Americans to ask ourselves any questions. We talk about what happened, but never why it happened. It is a society in which people never examine themselves, why we don't have health care, why we don't do this, why we don't do that. We just think we're perfect as we settle into the, I think, the muck of eventual self-destruction.
These are big words and big ideas, Randall Robinson. You're the kind of social critic that the United States, at least, says it likes to keep around for its health, for its self-examination.
Well, the strange thing about quitting America, this is my fourth book for Dutton, and this one has the largest white readership of any book that I've written, and it's drawn hundreds of letters, fully half of which come from white readers, all of which tell me that they want to leave the United States. The Cattician mission to the United Nations has been inundated with letters from white and black Americans, but disproportionately white Americans.
The Cattician, that is the St. Kitts, that's the St. Kitts mission.
Mm. Yes.
But you know, in as much as 275 million or 300 million Americans cannot move to St. Kitts or anywhere like that, we're sitting back here trying to take stock of what you're saying and figure out what it means and how to take it on board and what on earth to do with it. And we see that there's a warm and positive side in a strong sense to what you're saying, that you're there in pursuit of community and what you see as a saner way of life. There's also a very angry and disillusioned and alarmed side. You write, Randall Robinson, that America has never been more dangerous to the world than now. Wounded lion, judgment warped by anger, no longer killing for food alone, blind with the cool, organized rage of the European of the species, serving notice now to the entire planet, shedding all pretense, dispensing with all of its tribe's thin shibboleths about justice and fairness. And right on it goes. This dangerous, wounded animal, all because of 9/11?
No. Long before 9/11. Clearly, America is now the world's sole remaining superpower, having won the Cold War, and because of the technology of warfare, the United States, buoyed by its enormous economic power, stands alone atop the world as the most fearsome power in the history of civilized society. I don't think there's any question about that. And there are no checks and balances globally that the United States respects. It appears prepared to do anything to anybody in any place. And because it controls the machineries of information, it can bring the story of what it has done out the way it wants to bring the story. What we have done in Haiti recently is just enormously heinous. How we would destroy the poorest country in the hemisphere in its first democratic start in 200 years after the way we are recorded in its history as having been hostile for all of those 200 years, from Jefferson to the Emancipation Proclamation with sanctions, and then Woodrow Wilson's murderous invasion in 1915, in which some 15,000 Haitians lost their lives at the hands of U.S. Marines, and then the military support of Duvalier's Pauper and Son, and now this hostility towards Aristide in a coup that began in 1994, shortly after the Republicans took control of the Congress and began to strangle the Haitian economy so that President Aristide would have nowhere to go. And then the final blow last Sunday, in which he was abducted and taken involuntarily into exile at gunpoint by the most powerful country in the world, aiming its full force at one of the weakest countries in the world, is an extraordinary demonstration of the lengths to which this country will go unchecked by any morality, any sense of self-recognized decency. Iraq is just another example where we don't bother to let facts or principles stand in our way. We don't let that impede us. There were no weapons of mass destruction. I wrote that in the book in the spring. Now, if I could know that in the spring, that there was no connection to 9/11, that there were no weapons of mass destruction, that there was no valid reason against the opinion of the world community to attack a country that offered no real threat to America, and to destroy civilian life that we haven't bothered to even to tally. If I could know that in the spring, certainly our leaders had to have known that. It's a vastly immoral enterprise.
Renner Robinson, we'll turn to Iraq, but I want to ask you about Haiti. You write extremely fondly of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who you count as a very close friend. You describe him as one of the only true Christians, or the few true Christians you've ever known. And yet we have heard in recent weeks from all kinds of sources lots of criticism of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Do you lay everything that's happened at the feet of the United States here? Does he have any fault in how things have unfolded in Haiti in his own circumstances today?
He has no responsibility at all for the collapse of his own democracy, largely because America began to do that. Here are some of the things that we did. First of all, Haiti is so different from the rest of the Caribbean because Haitians have had to pay for their successful revolution against the French going back two centuries. They defeated the armies of Napoleon Bonaparte and Britain and Spain and faced down Thomas Jefferson and destroyed French ambitions for empire in this hemisphere, making available to us, by the way, the Louisiana Territory for purchase. But we rewarded them with hostility, with first comprehensive global sanctions against this black republic that so threatened George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, and on through a 200-year period. And so for the first time in 1991, they got their chance for a democratic society and elected overwhelmingly Aristide, who has been elected twice, the last time by 92% of the population. Clearly, there were never any questions about the fairness and validity of those two elections. But the first coup had all over it the fingerprints of the American CIA that trained and operated the FRAP thugs that, when they were chased out of the country with the American invasion by Clinton, later hid across the border in the Dominican Republic, were armed by America, directed by America, and came back to join the opposition that we created with an appropriated $3 million a year from the United States to destabilize Haiti's new democracy.
Randall Robinson, please stand by in St. Kitts. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about giving up on America with African-American activist in exile, Randall Robinson. His new book is Quitting America, You can join the conversation. Can you feel the depth of disillusion that would lead an American, a black American, to just walk away? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about giving up on America with African-American activist in exile, Randall Robinson. That's voluntary exile. He describes his reasons for going to St. Kitts in the Caribbean in the new book, Quitting America. You can join our conversation tonight. Is Randall Robinson right? Is the U.S. a staggering, corrupt giant that does not finally care for anything but itself, and really its white self? Is it as bad as that? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Randall Robinson, you said on Friday, speaking of Secretary of State Colin Powell, you said he is the most powerful and damaging black to rise to influence in the world in my lifetime. Wow, that's hot.
Well, he's allowed himself to be used at the State Department by the Bush administration as a Trojan horse of sorts. In this case, by Roger Noriega, the policymaker who crafted this idea of demonizing Aristide and invading Haiti and allowing what happened to this democracy to happen. The policy obviously was a great deal more globally palatable if it had on it a black face, and that's what Secretary Powell has allowed. But even before this, even before he became Secretary of State, he was completely unsympathetic to those in the Democratic Caribbean community who appealed to the United States not to make war against its banana-producing economies, like Dominica and St. Lucia and St. Vincent economies that depend for 85% of their income on the sale of bananas to a European market that major banana growers like Chiquita had problems with and went to war to wrest from the European Union the special market that they had created for Caribbean banana products.
So in the Caribbean
estimated these economies, banana growers in the Caribbean committing suicide and that sort of thing, Powell completely unsympathetic. And he has been that way towards Haiti as well. And you stop me now, and there's another story to tell about what he has done.
Well, I mean, I've seen the criticism that you've made, not only of Colin Powell in the Caribbean, but really globally. And I want to come back to U.S. policy. If you'd be good enough, Randall Robinson, we don't have forever tonight. I want to get to some core issues here. I wish you would speak to race in your current attitude toward the United States and your decision to leave it. You write about the race cross. You say it weighs heavily upon blacks, like broken chainmail army on weary ancient soldiers. But you also write that you found before your departure that not many blacks are even thinking about such things. You write, much less talking about them. You write that you'd come to feel increasingly isolated. How did you understand yourself racially as a human being in U.S. society before your departure, and how widespread do you think your self-understanding was shared in the black community?
Well, I recall when we started the program, I was a bit troubled by your characterization of my act as one of rather almost sad disillusion. And charged with a kind of anger. I don't think blacks are largely disillusioned. Blacks in America have never been illusioned so that they can't be disillusioned. We have always been preoccupied with the question of race, largely because minorities have to be. It is never out of our consciousness. It is always there. And to the extent that there is anger, it's a well-banked fire, a kind of retrograde, steady burn anger that that the society makes necessary at all times. When one leaves America and you go to other places like here, race is not so much a preoccupation of people who live here, because it doesn't have to be. They really don't understand the Black American preoccupation with this question that we have to have to defend ourselves against the menace that is always there in American society. But if it's, you see, Blacks and whites in America see the world through the lens of an entirely, almost diametrically opposed, different sets of assumptions. Race is always on our minds. I doubt if it is even frequently on the minds of whites. They are the majority. They control the society. We are controlled by the society. And many Blacks, of course, as a sort of methodology of getting along in the society, develop the opinions, or at least accede to them, of the mainstream. And the lesson to Colin Powell, for instance, and people like him: if you want to enjoy that kind of spectacular job success, then you go along with the mainstream, notwithstanding what the consequences will be for people who look like you. And if you don't go along with the mainstream and decide to swim against that that tide, then there are certain kinds of success that you're never going to have available to you, and you have to accept that as a price of your commitment or the way you choose to see yourself.
Randall Robinson, I want to ask you, though, if I may, you know that at least in many white American minds, at least, there is the notion or the hope that the country has moved or is moving toward some circumstance or future where the races will get along well, will get along harmoniously. So when someone like you completely checks out, it's disturbing. It seems to fly straight in the face of that whole idea. You say at the end, by the end of the book, that you have two countries in a way. The one is the country of your birth, but the other essentially is the country of your race. You say, I tried to love America. I tried to love America. Then I stopped trying to love America. And that leaving that behind settled upon me like an ancient ancestor's ceremonial robe, warm and splendid and as old as time. What is the message here for African Americans, that they too should give up on the American part of that hyphenated phrase?
Well, I don't think that's a voluntary decision. I would dare say that everybody has to do this calculus for themselves. But I don't think that the vast majority of Black Americans see the world very much differently than I do. And as I said, this is not a voluntary decision-making process. It is there in front of you. There's little other choice to make. And you see, white Americans, I can't speak for white Americans. I can only speculate. I can only guess at how they see things. But progressive whites, of course, I think bothered that I could chuck it all and not care a whit about it. I mean, I'm happier now than I've ever been in my life, having left. I wish I had done it many years before. I think that bothers whites, because one likes to think, well, we're making racial progress. And you see, if we're taking a bag at a time off the mean boat and lightening the load, then that means we're making progress. But you see, who's carrying the load that's being lightened? It's not good enough to do it a bag at a time. It is still painful, and one uses up one's life bearing the pain, whether it is the old big pain or the lesser contemporary pain. It is still pain. We've still got, 1/20th of the world's population, 1/4 of the world's prisoners, 2 million and climbing, half of whom are African Americans, who make up half of those who are sentenced to death. And those who are committed or convicted of felonies in the United States who are Black will serve a prison sentence exactly twice as long as the white counterpart will. 14% of American drug use is Black, but 75% of prison admissions for Black are Black. We have captured and corralled and strangled the next generation of young black men, with one-third of our young men under control of the criminal justice system in one way or another in our major cities.
Randall Robinson,
New York black men are unemployed, on and on and on. We're making progress, but not in time to salvage the lives of these black people whose lives are being used up by that system.
Well,
and there's no excuse for it.
Randall Robinson, it breaks my heart to see a black man like you check out, and yet we're reading and listening and learning. A lot of callers want to join our conversation. If you'll allow me, I'd like to invite them in. Terry's calling from Rochester, New York. Hi, Terry. You're on the air.
Good evening, Tom.
Hi.
I could not agree more with this gentleman. I am a 43-year-old white female, college-educated, corporate downsized from the high-tech space, who found herself in Scotland a couple of years ago on holiday with the last of my frequent flyer miles, and found my soul standing in the Highlands, and am in the process of trying to immigrate to Scotland. Because like this gentleman and probably a whole lot of other people, I've had it with the narcissism and the imperialistic tendencies our country has started to embrace. And if you go back in history, I can't speak to being a minority of color. I can't even begin to touch on that. But if you look at what happened with Rome and you look at what happened with the British Empire, we are doing exactly the same thing. And in the end, we call it peace, but it's desolation at the end of this. And I can't thank you enough for having this conversation. I thought I was the only person who wanted to check out on America and go live someplace else where values were more homespun and real, in a sense of knowing what's valuable, instead of a bigger car, a bigger house, and a country club membership.
Terry, we've got it, and thank you for your call. Let me turn to Randall Robinson on that point. Randall Robinson, here's a white American looking to leave the United States. She's headed for Scotland. Let me just ask you on that point, though. Is that a place to run to? Maybe it is for her, but what about for you? What about for the world? You're pretty tough on the white world in general in this book. You write, for example, from Columbus forward, I know of no sustained contact with Western whites that black and brown peoples and their cultures have survived undevastated anywhere. You write, it has never failed to hold true. Western whites, once well inside the place of another's different, less pugnacious, more welcoming culture, destroy it root and branch.
Well, I think that's the case. I mean, you'd ask the Aborigines in Australia. You ask the indigenous people in Latin America. You'd ask people anywhere across the globe what happens, what happened in Canada, what happened to Native Americans. We can't seem to appreciate the values of people who don't cherish stuff, and how to recreate it with tolerances that are almost nil for production to market to the world. If I said to you how we define success in America, and I presented two models, and I was talking about the cab driver whose spouse was happily married to the cab driver, and they had four wonderful children, and they were doing well in school, and they had big family dinners, and they loved each other enormously, and they were well-adjusted, law-abiding, God-fearing people on the one hand. And on the other hand, we had a neurosurgeon who beat his wife, or she badgered her husband, and they hated each other in a dysfunctional family, and the children were out of control and suicidal and that sort of thing, riddle independent and that kind of thing. One would say that the neurosurgeon in America was successful. Nobody ever describes the cab driver as successful, because Americans and generally Europeans only know how to describe success in terms of money. It does not nourish the spirit. And we can't even have the national discussion about what ails us as a country, what is killing our spirit, what causes us to do these murderous things to people, how we can have a discussion in our country on Sunday morning about the war in Iraq and not even live up to the British standard of inviting to the discussion an Iraqi or an Arab, or to have in that discussion people who represent really different points of view. But Americans think nothing about having four white Americans discuss what we're doing in another society, another culture, 8,000 miles from home, where our policymakers over there talk about who the foreigners are operating in the country.
Randall Robinson,
without even recognizing for a moment who the real foreigners are in that country, the farthest away from home.
Let me ask you then, take that all the way up to the top level. What's the prescription here? These are, and you've got it here at length, and you've got chapter and verse, but it's a very damning view of the white Western world that's in charge. And you don't go through the sort of typical American backflip of saying the ordinary Americans are fine. In fact, you say specifically, you say, damn the sadists, damn even more the indifferent, normal Americans. So what's your prescription for a planet that is dominated by, I guess you would say, by Western white corporations, power and influence? What's the way out? What's the way forward?
Of course. I was Ralph Nader's campaign, one of his vice chairs before. I think Ralph is right, quite right in suggesting that we are a corporate-run society. In the last analysis, we've got to understand what democracy requires of us. Democracy is not about elections alone. That's the sort of small theater role played in it. That's a procedural thing. You have elections. But democracy requires of little d Democrats the responsibility of participating in the process to make those we would elect to govern to account to us for what they do. It means that you don't have a democracy without an enlightened citizenry. Everything about the democratic process in America now runs against that kind of grain. Politicians want the electorate to be less enlightened, less active, less involved. We ought to be asking questions. We ought to take back our democracy. We ought to wonder what kind of society we have. We ought to be tremendously irate that we've got 43 million Americans without health care. It ought to bother us that we've got the largest per capita prison population in the world, that to Europeans even, capital punishment is barbaric. We ought to ask questions about why these things are happening, these outrageous crimes, why kids in white high schools in places like Colorado are doing these kinds of things to their fellow students. That ought to trouble us. But we seem numbed, and we just follow the leaders. How we could put in the presidency somebody so conspicuously as untalented, as incapable, as the current president.
Randall Robinson, stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking with Randall Robinson. His new book is Quitting America. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about giving up on America with African-American activist in voluntary exile, Randall Robinson, founder of Trans Africa. He's author of the new book, Quitting America, The Departure of a Black Man from His Native Land. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Randall Robinson joins us tonight from his new home in the Caribbean in St. Kitts. Benjamin's calling right now from Boston. Hi, Benjamin. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom, for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Let me start by saying that, Randall Robinson, I've been following you all these years, and thank you very much for everything you've done in Africa, particularly I'm from Nigeria. I have to say that you are not alone in this aspect. I came to the United States 22 years ago, and believe me, what I've seen about this country is not what I had in mind when I came. Talking about Colin Powell, I think Colin Powell doesn't have a mind of his own. And not only has he let himself to be used and abused, he's nothing but a stooge to this administration. I came to this country, but following the history of the United States and their foreign policies, this country preaches about democracy and doesn't practice it. All they are concerned with is how to take advantage of countries all over the world.
But Benjamin, 22 years and you're still here. Why?
I'm building my house in Nigeria, and in the next 2 years, I'll be moving my family, 3 kids, back to Nigeria. He's not alone. A lot of us have gone. They have one leg in Nigeria and one leg in America. They don't see America as a place they will ever leave and ever make a decent life anymore, both for their kids. They're even worried about their own kids more than they worry about themselves. This country, I'm sorry to say this, the way Americans elect their president is what is going to bring this country down. They have been electing people who are not only less qualified, but have no interest about this country in mind.
Benjamin, we've got it. I want to thank you for your call. Randall Robinson, I know Benjamin's talking about taking his family back to Nigeria, and others have. You took your young daughter to St. Kitts. Why was it important to you to have her, she's 10, 11, 12 now.
Well, she was 11. She's 14 now.
What has been the value of the experience of being outside the United States for an African American, at least was, girl?
Well, she's had an unusual life, very different from mine at her age. I was 13 before I left the state of Virginia and thought I was going abroad when I crossed over into North Carolina. She has been to 22 countries, and so she's traveled the world because her parents travel a lot. And so she's had a different experience, and this has been a wonderful one for her. Our life in D.C. presented her with us with difficult choices for her. The public system was unsatisfactory, largely because of what happens to public systems all over the country.
But you say you wanted her to experience at least part of her childhood in a racially freight-free environment. What does that mean?
Well, we wanted to see herself in the culture. We wanted her to grow up in a place that affirmed her. We didn't want her to enter her teens having to face the kind of social racism that she was going to see and had already seen in private school Washington. We didn't want her to be scarred by that. We wanted her to feel beautiful and tall and capable, and we wanted her self-esteem to survive adolescence intact.
And is that impossible in the United States?
It is very difficult. It's extremely difficult, even for the most successful of us.
The daughter of a Harvard Law graduate, a prominent man, going to, all the right places in the United States, still can't happen as a black, as an African-American girl?
It is difficult to have it happen inside the spirit where it counts. You see, you're not doing this. I realize you're playing devil's advocate, but you must understand all questions can't be answered with material success and prestige assignment. That in the last analysis, all blacks in America, or at least on a few questions, are all still in the same boat, the rich and the poor, with respect to the way the society has elected to see them time immemorial. And so that doesn't make any difference. I don't want to be decided. I didn't want to live in a subculture. I don't want to be sub anything. I want the culture to be my culture. Whites have had no experience with that. And because they haven't, they have a kind of choking arrogance. I think perhaps a small experience with it would make them at least a bit more empathetic.
Randall Robinson, I'm still trying to say this
for not just speaking for blacks, but I probably speak for Hispanics and Asian Americans and Native Americans, people who are relatively invisible in an America that doesn't bother to visit or learn about anybody's culture or history, but its own mainstream culture and history.
I'm still trying to look ahead from your perspective as someone who's not planning on leaving the country and who has hopes for the country, and I find it very difficult to discern the outline of the reform or change or success that you didn't find. Are you suggesting that everybody should emigrate back to racially secluded origins or something?
I'm suggesting that we need to kindle a spirit for a fight in America to make it the multicultural society that it ought to be, where cultures are on par with each other, where there is no mainstream culture, where we really respect the idiom of other cultures, that we really want to visit the Native American history and experience and understand it and how it can benefit us. And so much in the Native American story that can save America from itself, that we ought to understand this about the Hispanic Americans and Asian Americans.
But I don't read hope in your writing that that's ever going to happen.
No, it can't happen unless people make it happen. People in power have no interest in such happening. This has to happen from the ground up. People have to empower themselves. And that is the real test of democracy, you see. Democracy means activist participation from the level of the voter. As Louis Brandeis said, the most important office in a democracy is the office of citizen.
But you've checked out. You've left. You walked away from that office, Randall Robinson.
I'm 62 years old. I'm tired of America. I'm tired of its baggage. I'm happy where I am. I didn't like it. I don't like it. I'm done with it.
And have you found what you wanted, what you need on an island in the Caribbean?
Gloriously. We don't have a stoplight on this island. A terribly decent and civilized place. I mean, one goes so many experiences that I've seemed even gauche by participation in, where the first thing I have been instructed to ask of people with whom I'm negotiating with is what something will cost, and people look at me strangely and saying, we'll get to that later. Let's talk about the job first. We'll even do it for you, and we'll see what's a fair price.
Randall Robinson, we're out of time with that. We're sorry to lose you. We wish you well there. Keep writing. Keep writing to us. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks, Tom. Take care.
Randall Robinson joining us from St. Kitts. His new book is Quitting America, The Departure of a Black Man from His Native Land. In a moment, remembering Spalding Gray. This is On Point. Actor Spalding Gray was confirmed dead today, 2 months after his wife reported him missing. His body was recovered from the East River near Greenpoint, Brooklyn. He was 62. A practiced storyteller, Gray became famous for his monologues. Sitting behind a desk with a glass of water and his notebook, he would transform his life experiences into a performed autobiography. He always said he was simply an actor performing the role of Spalding Gray. His works included Swimming to Cambodia, where he chronicled his experience acting in the movie The Killing Fields. James Leverett is a professor in the Department of Dramaturgy and Dramatic Criticism at Yale School of Drama and was a longtime friend of Spalding Gray. In this radio diary, he remembers the genius of Spalding Gray's monologues.
It was deceptively simple. I know how much really artistry went into his molding a piece. He had a really interesting method of doing it, which was a kind of verbal writing. He would dictate into a recorder and then listen over and over again. He would write notes, and it was very carefully crafted, but it was crafted in such a way as to look utterly natural and spontaneous and making everybody else think, oh, well, I can do that too.
The other day, I am walking out of her loft. I have an empty Molson Gold bottle in my hand. I don't know. I guess I was going to get my nickel back. And I'm seized with these party sounds upstairs. I'm not out of control. It's a classic Greek rage. My head and gut are completely balanced. My gut is wrenching with butterflies. My head has that old adage, that old ticker tape going across the forehead, you know, that old adage, all weakness tends to corrupt. Impotence corrupts absolutely. And I just took that bottle and hurled it. Went up two flights of stairs, exploded, boom, glass everywhere like a glass hand grenade. They charged out with their bats and guns. I ran. Because it was an act of passion, I forgot to tell Renee I was going to do it, and she was way behind me picking up plastic garbage bags. So by the time she got to the door, they caught her. But they didn't do anything because she was innocent. She had no idea what they were talking about, and she recognized, they recognized this innocence, so they didn't kill her. So there's hope. But I say, how does a country like America, or rather, how does America, because certainly there's no country like it, begin to find the language to negotiate or talk with a country like Russia or Libya? If I can't even begin to get it with my people on the corner of Broadway and John Street.
The thing that I think people really didn't realize about the work is that it wasn't just him massaging his ego, that it was so carefully put together, and it was put together in a way to encompass and to reflect what was going on in the world. Spalding became a kind of everyman, this every guy that wore L.L. Bean shirts and had all of these experiences, buying a house and having a family. And he became the archetypal baby boomer, really.
The first thing that happens when we get there is that the air conditioner breaks. Then the electric windows break, the radiator boils over, and the entire exhaust system is dragging on the ground by the end of the day. I am laughing. I find this very funny. Ira is not laughing. He is sweating. This man sweats like an Ira, I would have to say. They are changing his shirt. He is back there in a slough of despond because for the first time in his life, he's studying Stanislavski in acting, and he's brought the textbook An Actor Prepares and building a character, and he's trying to do an emotional memory because the director, Roland Joffe, has told him to look like he's on the verge of tears, and he's trying to be on the verge of tears all day just in case they turn the camera on. He is in a slough of despond in the back seat thinking about something awful from his past. Up until then, we've been friends. Now he's not talking to me. I'm bored, so I'm talking to the driver. He's an extra, an American expatriate from San Francisco who says America has gone to the dogs, gone to the wow-wows, he called it. And he's gone to Thailand, the Pure Land, to become an elephant expert, and he is working for the Thai Agricultural Committee counting elephants. That's what he does for a living. He sleeps at night with the elephants on the ground. The elephants sleep standing up. In the day, he gets up with his little elephant counter and goes out counting the elephants. The only problem is, he said, he has a bum leg now, a game leg, and he can't outrun an elephant if it charges, and it will charge in its sleep if you wake it. And he said he may be killed within the next month or so by an elephant. In the middle of all this, Ira Wheeler looks up and says, "Will you stop it, please? Will you stop whatever it is you're talking about up there? I am trying to have an emotional memory." I said, "Ira, here is a man that's actually about to be killed by an elephant. Try working with that one."
He should be remembered as an extraordinary seminal artist. His way of being in the world and of portraying that, of performing that, I know for me, that was the way that we were in the world in the 70s and 80s and 90s. It didn't apply to everyone. Spalding was the archetypal WASP, you know, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. There he was. But I think parts of him applied to everyone, in this culture at least. And he left an extraordinary body of work that embodies that.
Professor James Leverett of the Yale School of Drama. He was a longtime friend of Spalding Gray. Spalding Gray was confirmed dead today. He was 62. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.